That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Coming to you live from our houses in Los Angeles, California, it's Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, your comedy field guide to life. Tonight, taxes. Tax time is upon us, which means you've got to gather up your 1099 forms, pull out your Schedule A, get out your 1040, grab a pencil, and use it to commit harikari. Dr. Nicholas Duquette from the Price School of Public Policy at USC is here to answer our questions about taxation. We promise it won't be a taxing experience. Plus, quotations! We'll get to those favorite quotes we didn't have time for in the last show. As Benjamin Franklin said, promises may get thee friends, but non-performance will turn them into enemies. We don't want to be nobody's enemies, so we promise we'll deliver memorable quotations. I'm Adam Felber, the man who audits every show, trying to itemize our topics into the correct conversational category and end our broadcast on line 23 without owing the audience an incoherency penalty. And now, please welcome the woman who deducts logic from every conversational return she files, Paula Poundstone!
Hey, you guys. So lovely to be here. Hey, Adam, Tony, Bonnie, and thanks to tonight's house band, trumpeter Christopher Still from the Los Angeles Philharmonic. Thank you, Christopher, for being with us.
Wow, Christopher Still. We got a ringer in here tonight.
Yeah, we're way up. We're way up in the musical hierarchy, and wow. and you can hear it. Nice.
I tell you that intro was like an aerobic exercise for me, Paula. Take over.
Was it?
Yeah,
Why?
It was taxing. Why? I think Ken Lezebnik's trying to kill me. A lot of hard consonants in there. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize that consonants could be tiring. Maybe that's what's wrong with me all the time.
I need a nap.
I didn't know. You know what I do late at night is I make those cameo videos that we talk about sometimes. I make videos that people order through Cameo, and they are messages from one person to another. So, you know, somebody will write and say, like, here's an example of one that happened recently. Somebody wrote and said, my mother-in-law, I want you to say blah, blah, blah to my mother-in-law for me, okay? And so here's how I do it. I say the blah, 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 and then usually I say, hey, this is Paula Poundstone, and, you know, Ursula was the mother-in-law, and I say, Ursula, it's me, Paula Poundstone, and I'm talking to you on behalf of, you know, Betsy, and, you know, Betsy wants you to know blah, 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 right? And then I just sort of drift off and I talk. In the way that you might be familiar with. So I said on this one for Betsy's mother-in-law, Ursula, I said, somewhere along the way, I said, oh, I have 9 cats and 2 big dogs. And then I said, well, you know, so I live alone. Maybe that's why. And then I said, well, no, really, it's probably because I don't like sex. And then I said, you know, I work so hard, Ursula. And this, frankly, is a joke from my act. I say, the idea that I would go into my bedroom and there'd be someone in there with whom I had to have an activity is just upsetting to me. So, you know, whatever. And then I talk a little bit more. I say, okay, Ursula, you know, love from Betsy and good talking to you. End of thing. So now I get a note from Betsy saying, you know, I can't use that video. because it is going to weird my mother-in-law out that you don't have sex.
Oh, my God.
Is that the strangest thing you ever... I'm like, okay, what? And this is the question that's been plaguing me ever since. It's literally kept me up at night. Why does Ursula want me to have sex? Why is that important to Ursula? What, honestly, what business is it of hers?
Well, that's the nerve. If I may venture an opinion, Paula Poundstone, I don't
think
don't think Ursula really wants you to have sex. She might consider it unusual that you would choose to talk about that in a message from her to her mother-in-law.
Well, the likelihood, so we're assuming then, I mean, unless it's a same-sex couple, we're assuming that Betsy is married to Ursula's son. Well, I don't know what Ursula thinks they're doing together, but probably the same thing that Ursula did to get Betsy to begin with. So I don't think I'm broaching with mentioning sex a fresh topic to either Betsy or Ursula. And honestly, I didn't describe sex. I said I didn't do it. It would be one thing if I talked about a penis plunging into a vagina. That's not what I said.
Yeah, but then again, you did bring the whole topic up, didn't you?
No. I said the idea that I would go into my bedroom and there'd be someone in there with whom I had to have an activity is just upsetting to me. Well, apparently, see, my guess is Ursula would have thought it was funny, but it's Betsy that had a problem with it.
What if Ursula was recently widowed? That would be an incredibly depressing message.
No, if Ursula was recently widowed, then we're in the same situation.
Right, except you're reminding her of the empty bedroom she comes home to every day.
No, I'm showing her the glories of it. Ursula, go to sleep. Get up. Do something fun the next day.
Now you're
coming up with a dark background to the story. I don't think that was the case.
You think Ursula just wants you to get it on with somebody?
Why does Ursula want me to have sex? The question is pounding away at me. It's eating away at me. Why does Ursula want me to have sex? It's not Ursula's business. Speaking of business, Adam.
Yes.
As treasurer of our book club.
It's time for our book club, our reading of Moby Dick. Our slow, grinding sail through the oceans.
Our recently founded book club. And by the way, I have tweeted to Jon Favreau from Pod Save America and tried to invite him to join our book club. Haven't heard a word from him.
He's probably just thinking about it.
Yeah. Probably. He's probably, trying to get the book to catch up. Just hasn't had time to respond. That's got to be it.
That's probably it.
But I am the treasurer of the book club, and I would like to make my weekly report. This week, I did buy some tub toys in order to perform a reenactment of the ship scenes in Moby Dick. So we are another $9.99 in the red, and I'm not happy to say that we have had no income this week. I know I've put Bonnie Burns onto coming up with a fundraising device because the pressures of being the treasurer, that and recently upsetting Ursula, have really, sidelined me.
Bonnie, how's the fundraising going? If Paula spent $9.99 on tub toys, where are we with fundraising?
Yeah, so I think she's, which she should know because she's a treasurer, I think she's about $11.98 or something out of pocket. You know, I haven't figured out yet what the fundraiser should be. I'm still contemplating it, and I don't want to clutter up what it's going to be with a lot of unnecessary thoughts. So I'm
okay, but we're going to need that money. Paula's spending this club under the out of commission. We're going to need you to do something. Set up a Kickstarter or something, Bonnie.
No, small fortune has gone into the book club. A small fortune.
I'll have it
already.
I'll have it by next week.
All right.
All right.
I have a theme song. I have a theme song, but I don't think I have the nerve to sing it.
A theme song for the book club?
I do. I mean, we could put that out, but I don't think we could put it out because I don't think I even have the nerve to sing it.
Oh, of course you do. Sing it.
No,
sing.
I think this is what I think it's like. You know, sometimes I get these ideas that I think are like great ideas. And then I call Paula and I go, you know, what about this? And then even as I'm telling it, I think it must have been like I was by myself and I thought this was a great idea. And then when I said it out loud, it's not such a great idea. And
now, let me ask you, was that the theme song right there?
No.
Okay.
The theme song might be, I thought this was good. And then like, okay, I hope this isn't like when a comedian is on stage and then like they tell a joke and the whole audience is just like sitting there and they don't laugh at all. Okay.
Okay.
Here we go. Okay. I will say this, at least I came up with a theme song for the book club.
Okay.
Okay. Here we go. Oh, I hope I don't laugh. Okay. Moby Dick is smarter than the average whale. Moby Dick is smarter than a millionaire. When you're out at sea, you will find him there, scarfing up more vessels than the average whale. Lose your leg, lose your leg, lose your leg.
Wow. Well, that's just fantastic. I love that. That's
my favorite part is lose your leg. It reminds me of Ooga Shaka, Ooga Shaka. Lose your leg, lose your leg.
It's just, there's so many layers to it, Bonnie. I love it. I love that he's smarter than the average whale and a millionaire.
Yeah.
You know,
not quite
this
sure what
explains,
led to that non-rhyming inspiration, but it's fantastic.
There was a funny thing about the rhymes, wasn't there? But this explains why you weren't available on the phone all week.
Yeah.
This must have really taken some time.
Do I drum up work for my client, Paula? Or do I write the theme song to the Moby Dick book club?
No, but you know, so
I,
often...
And I hate to be a stickler. I love that song, but it is... It's a theme song for Moby Dick, not for a book club.
Oh, that's a good point. You're going to have to do a new theme
song. We're
going to
need a new song
change
next
the
week.
Book.
Yeah, let's come up with one for the club.
Yeah, what was that? How about this? Eat, Pray, Fuck is a stupid book. Lose your leg, lose your leg, lose your leg.
All right. And on that, let's turn to our discussion of today's chapters. Now, we went ahead and got ambitious. We read chapters 17, the Ramadan, through 22, where the ship actually takes off. So, Paula Poundstone, this podcast is named after you. So, what'd you think?
I read Ramadama Ding Dong, which is...
Yeah.
It's Ramadan with jazz hands. The Ramadan thing was that Queequeg was in his inn room... And Ishmael, you know, can't stir him. And they eventually, I don't think they broke the door down, did they? Eventually, maybe they got a key and went in. And
no, they busted
just,
in.
Oh, did they? And it turns out that Queequeg was worshiping. He was in sort of a worshiping trance, and he just wasn't going to get up and get the door. So take away the worshiping part, and it's probably like lots and lots of partners. When my kids lived at home, how many times did I have to say, someone's at the door? And no one was, apparently I'm the only one who can get the door. I didn't realize that they were participating in Ramadan at the time. And then after that, after the Ramadan chapter, was that the one where, they meet Elijah, I think?
They meet Elijah, who's clearly a crazy man who's got some... prophecies he wants to say about what's going to happen on the Pequod, but doesn't quite say it?
Yeah, yeah. It's sort of, you know, foreshadowing that something weird is going to happen on the Pequod. And then, again, keeping up with the religious theme, Elijah, who, they don't know what to make of Elijah. He's just a weird guy they bump into on the street, and then he hides the afikoman, and
does he?
They have to go look for it.
Yeah, I must have just kind of glazed over during that part of that chapter.
Yeah, yeah, that happens. And then at one point, Ishmael, maybe in the next chapter when he's talking about when they're boarding the ship and the ship's been loaded and everything, there's this great quote where he says, "When a man suspects any wrong, it sometimes happens that if he be already involved in the matter, he insensibly strives to cover up his suspicions, even from himself." And, you know, I listened to the audio version of the book, and right at that point, you could just hear Mike Pence wailing in the background of the recording.
I had the same thought. It's absolutely that sort of like, that's Mike Pence and I guess many other Republicans managed to willfully blind themselves to stuff.
Pence is all throughout Moby Dick.
He really
is. Melville was so prescient. He has Mike Pence in here over and over again. "When a man suspects any wrong, it sometimes happens that if he be already involved in the matter, he insensibly strives to cover up his suspicions, even from himself."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then the next thing you know, the guy you work for dispatches a mob to murder you on Capitol Hill.
Yeah. Yeah. So the new copies of Moby Dick, instead of having a picture of Ahab and the whale on the cover, have the mob and the noose on the cover. It's actually uses the Capitol.
That is some trenchant analysis, Paula Poundstone.
Yeah. So that's what I got. What about you guys?
Let's go to Sherman Oaks and Tony Anita Hull for her close and incisive reading of the text.
Yeah, so we're 22 chapters in, and we haven't even met Captain Ahab yet. There have been chapters about every meal, but still no Captain Ahab.
I got to tell you, Tony, I'm kind of liking the fact we haven't met him yet. It's building up this tension because there, you know, remember, they're still saying last week I was pointing out that there was this long speech that they were rationalizing that, you know, "I'm sure he'll be fine." And now there's been this one more reference from the owner of the boat as they're setting out to sea. And he's like, "Oh, I'm sure he'll come out as soon as the sun emerges and that'll do him a world of good."
it's like he's getting better all the time.
Oh, yeah, don't you worry about a thing. Just go out there. He'll be as right as rain.
Yeah, I can't do it.
So you're missing that we haven't met Captain Ahab yet?
Yeah.
Well, does this make you feel better? I listened to the whole book already. He's coming.
Unless you have something else, Tony, we'll go up to Simi Valley. Bonnie Burns.
Well, you know, Melville has this sense of humor. It really made me laugh when they're trying to get Queequeg, you know, out of the room, and they think that he's dead, and the landlady said, "Paint a sign, no suicides permitted here, and no smoking in the parlor."
I love that one. And she tags it, too. She tags the joke. She says, "No smoking in the parlor," and then says something like, "You might as well kill two birds with one stone."
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. And then
I'd already heard that from one of Tom Baudette's Motel 6 commercials. So that didn't, I just saw Melville ripping off Tom Baudette.
And then the, whatever those guys' names that have the ship, you know, they get the contract signed.
Oh, right. The two. Okay. Yes. Got you.
Bledad and whatever his name was.
The recruiters.
The recruiters.
The owners.
And then they keep calling Queequeg, Hedgehog, and Quahog.
Quahog, which is a clam from that region.
Oh, Quahog.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And then I looked up humbug and what was it? He was nothing but a humbug trying to be a bugbear. I had to look that up, but I thought it was a great sentence. Did you guys know what that was?
No. Well, humbug, isn't that like Dickens, just something that's not real?
Imposter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh. I didn't know that. I'll have to put that in the word, in the vocabulary song.
It's lies and nonsense is the bah humbug thing, as I always took it at least.
And then what about the bugbear?
What's a bugbear?
Isn't it a big mythical animal or something? Yeah.
Yeah, an imposter trying to be a monster. So.
Oh, that's great.
I breezed right by that.
Bonnie, you've been doing your homework.
Yeah.
Writing theme songs and taking names.
Hey.
All I want to add to all this from my perspective before we get to whatever Ken Lezebnik has to say about it is that, number one, it's kind of interesting because I think Ishmael might be an atheist, which is kind of awesome. Basically saying that Queequeg's religion is no more or less ridiculous than any of them. But also, he's such a drama queen. I love the giant freak out that he pulls just because Queequeg won't open the door. He's screaming like, stroke, get a doctor. Apoplectic fit. He's literally screaming and jumping and running around, and it's really funny that he, like, Jewish mother wise, he just goes from zero to he's dead in a crash in 10 seconds.
And yet he's going to be a whaler.
I know, he's going to panic.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's get to book club president Ken Lezebnik and his opinions, because he sent us an email with this update. Wait, I'm president? How did that happen? Well, your president is in Brooklyn looking at the New York Harbor and breathing fresh air. Ishmael told us he goes to sea as a sailor because, quote, of the wholesome exercise and pure air of the forecastle deck. In this world, headwinds are far more prevalent than winds from astern. That is, if you never violate the Pythagorean maxim. What is he saying here? Asked Ken. The Pythagorean injunction is to avoid eating beans, which causes flatulence. Really, that's what that really refers to. As we find out week after week, Moby Dick shies away from no part of the human experience.
I did notice the fart joke in chapter one.
Yes, and you mentioned it in chapter one weeks ago when we were covering chapter one.
Yeah, Ken just keeps saying he's in Brooklyn. Well, that's pretty funny. Because he's just been spotted in San Antonio, Texas. So I don't really see how the Brooklyn thing.
Yeah, he's in San Antonio, Texas, and he's not making a lot of headway in Moby Dick. Maybe he's just really fascinated with that first chapter, but he does seem to be punting it downfield.
Yeah.
Speaking of punting, Paula, I'm going to fall back 5 yards and ask if you're ready to bring out a vocabulary word.
I have a word, Adam. It's ubiquitous. It's an adjective that means, and it means present, appearing, or found everywhere. I'd heard the word ubiquitous many, many times, but honestly, I never knew what it meant. So here, I'll use it in a sentence. The corner bar is ubiquitous in Milwaukee. Adam, answer the phone.
What?
answer the phone.
All right, the contest is over. Still getting calls, huh? Okay. Hello?
Hi, Adam. It's me, Fairbanks Elementary School second grade teacher, Miss Nancy. I would like to perform this week's vocabulary song.
Miss Nancy, how nice to hear from you. How's the distance learning teaching going?
Oh, Adam, it is not easy. I want people to wear their masks and stay away from crowds so we can defeat this virus and get kids back in the classroom where they belong. It's so hard to teach second graders online. And instead of playing Duck, Duck, Goose, we play a game called Just Sit There and Don't Worry About the Fucking Goose.
Wow, you play that game with that name with second graders?
No, I threw in the fucking because it's a podcast.
Well, thank you for that. And I always admire a second grade teacher's willing to use her first name.
I felt free because it's a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. I'm glad that we were able to help you feel that sense of freedom. All right, Ms. Nancy, I don't see any reason not, if it's all right with Paula Poundstone, I don't see any reason not to let you sing the vocabulary song.
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead, Ms. Nancy.
Thank you very much. All right, here goes. This week's word is ubiquitous. It's an adjective that means present, appearing, or found everywhere. So many men are growing facial hair. Last week's word was obstreperous. It's an adjective that means noisy and difficult to control. Mo won't stop barking at people when they stroll. The week before that, the word was evanescent. It's an adjective that means, I had it a minute ago. I can almost see it. Smells like Evan. No, that's not it. Oh, go quickly fading from sight, memory, or existence. Like crews reflecting on the time they tried to kill Pence. Going back before that, we had rictus. It's a noun that means a fixed grimace or grin. I'm happy for the best actress, even though I didn't win. And not long ago, we had decoction. It's a noun that means the action or process of extracting the essence of something. An important part of natural healing. Let's never forget gallimaufry, which Paula pronounced wrong until nobody James Hyder corrected her. It's a noun that means confused jumble or medley of things. Hodgepodge, who's podge, hodgepodge. Adam doesn't think the song is replicable, replicable, replicable. But I do, I do, I do. Paula does, Paula does, Paula does too.
Miss Nancy.
That was really well done, Miss Nancy.
Yeah.
Oh, Miss Nancy, that was great. Thank you so much. I think you're better at the vocabulary song than I am, if you can believe that.
And I guess you've proved me wrong.
It was fun to do, but I was really, really nervous because I know Paula has set such a high bar.
I know, but I want to say, Miss Nancy, you hit both notes.
Oh, thank you, Adam. Coming from you, that is high praise.
Yeah, there are two notes in that song, and you hit them both. And you also proved me wrong because you proved that the song is replicable because there you just replicated it, Paula's song perfectly.
Oh, we sing it in my distance learning second grade class all the time.
I'm sure they love the bit about Putinesca. Well, thanks so much, Miss Nancy, for calling in.
Yeah, it was good talking to you. I gotta go. I gotta go. I gotta put myself right.
Thanks, Miss Nancy.
In a gallery view. I gotta be in gallery view.
Why can't I hang out with her after the game? Bye bye.
Bye bye. Bye bye.
Bye bye. Bye
bye. Bye bye.
Bye. Coming up, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said,
bye-bye, bye-bye.
Bye, Miss Nancy.
I'll talk
to you later. I'm hanging up the phone now.
All right, you do that. That's going to disconnect us. Go ahead.
I would hope. Click. Coming up, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said, bye-bye. I like to pay...
Bye-bye. Oh,
Jesus
I don't
Christ.
Think your bye. Phone is working. Bye-bye.
I guess not. Okay. Okay. Bye now. Coming up, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. said, I like to pay taxes. With them, I buy civilization. We'll hear about the role of taxes in all our lives. That's next on Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. Bye, Miss Nancy.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. There's something wrong with your phone, Adam.
I'm sure there is.
Hey guys, it's Adam, and tonight is January 3rd, and I am picking Giannis Antetokounmpo to score less than 36 points and James Harden to score more than 16. Why? Because I like beards. Am I putting a lot of money on this? I am not, because I'm not really a gambler, but I am having a lot of fun with Prize Picks. Prize Picks is the largest daily fantasy sports platform in North America. They're the easiest and most exciting way to play daily fantasy sports. It's just you against the numbers. Instead of battling thousands of other players, including pros and sharks, who I would lose to, you pick more or less than 2 to 6 player stat projections and watch the winnings roll in, or in my case, not. So I don't bet a lot. With the basketball season here, you can now pick combo projections across football and basketball from the Specials League, a league created specifically for combo projections that include 2 or more players from different sports or leagues. For example, LeBron James and Travis Kelce had a 10.5 combo of 3 points made, plus receptions. Do I get that? Kind of a little bit. Prize Picks even offers a reboot policy so that your entries stay in play even if one of your players gets injured. For football and basketball, if you have a player who exits the game in the first half and doesn't return in the second, that player is rebooted. So, it's like an insurance policy. Go to prizepicks.com/nobody and use code NOBODY for a first deposit match of up to $100. That's prizepicks.com/nobody and use code NOBODY for a first deposit match of up to $100. And then drop by and see how I did with the Greek Freak and Harden again on January 3rd. My hopes are not that high. Prize Picks, daily fantasy sports made easy.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
A detective came and knocked on the door, and I said, "Is it Renee?" And he just gave me that solemn look.
It was the worst day ever.
The Proof Podcast is back with a new case and a new season. 23 years ago, 18-year-old Renee Ramos went missing. Her body was later found in an empty Home Depot building on the edge of town.
I don't think that they arrested the right people. It's about time somebody's trying to do something.
She had a black eye about 2 weeks before she was murdered.
They are involved. They definitely had her body and her backpack.
You know people are going to judge you, right?
Of course. They're judging me now. They've been judging me damn near my whole life.
You can listen now to Season 2 of Proof, wherever you get your podcasts, and follow along with us as we reinvestigate the murder at the warehouse.
I have to ask, did you kill Renee?
On this day in unremarkable history, King George said, "No, no, let him have it. I'm playing the long game."
Thank you, house band Christopher Still, classing up the joint for us on the trumpet. Paula, it is tax time again.
Oh, boy. You know, I'm not so good at the tax. I mean, I actually like paying taxes, by the way, because I want to do my share. But determining what my share is not my strength.
So you don't do your own taxes? Have you ever?
No, I never have. I can tabulate the tip in a restaurant, but you don't need to do that anymore.
That's true. That's true and completely unrelated. Well, we are fortunate to have an expert on taxation and the history of taxes right here with us. Dr. Nicholas Duquette is an economist at USC's Saul Price School of Public Policy. His research is in public finance and economic history, with particular interest in the historical development of taxation and spending policy and the private nonprofit sector. Please welcome returning champion Nicholas Duquette.
Thank you.
Hey, welcome back.
Nicholas, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so what is the history of taxation? I know from the Disney animated version of Robin Hood that it was a process quite cruel to the church mice.
and it often can still feel that way if you, you know, if you don't get your papers in order. Usually when we talk about the, you know, tax season, of course, we're talking about filing your income tax return, which is now the main way that we pay taxes to the federal government. But, you know, for a long time, that wasn't actually even a thing in the U.S. Up until a little over 100 years ago, the main taxes that we paid to the federal government were either on imported goods, so stuff coming in. You know, they had a whole, they got really upset about taxation without representation and threw all the tea off the ships. And then they got the representation and then just kept taxing, you know, kept the taxation part pretty much like that. So stuff coming in.
So what was that? So wait, when you say stuff coming in, so if you, like, say, so they bring tea in from someplace else. And does that mean that the people on the ship who had the tea had to pay taxes? Does that mean that the people who bought the tea, like a cup of tea, they had to pay? Who was paying taxes on
That's
the
right.
tea?
So in order to bring it into the United States.
You can't, well, I don't know how long you've been a professor, but you can't say that's right to a multiple choice.
Well, in a way, it's both. In order to bring the tea into the U.S. or whatever else they were trying to bring in, they would have to get a little stamp or other certificate showing that the tax had been paid. So the person importing it would pay the tax, and then you know they would charge more for the tea at the tea store in order to make the money back. So you know the taxes would wind up getting paid by both sides, you know, effectively. But if you wanted to bring tea in, you had to pay the tea tax or the, you know, the molasses tax or whatever.
Were they big taxes? Because it seems like overthrowing the reigning government over a slightly more expensive tea is somewhat extreme. I don't want to call our founding fathers a bunch of hotheads, but that seems rash.
Well, they really liked tea. I mean, remember it was a British colony, so
yeah.
No, you know what it was? It was the Lipton family were just hotheads. You know, and the Celestial Seasoning family? Oh my God, they were seditionists.
Oh, the seasonings, yes. They were. They passed the TX.
Okay, so they started out taxing that way.
That's
and
right.
And then why did they change, and how did it change where you were filling out forms and stuff?
That's right. Well, they were charging if you wanted to bring stuff in, and then that wasn't enough money, you know, because it was just tea and things like that. So then they also started to have excise taxes on certain things that were made domestically, mostly alcohol and tobacco. So the
and
two
what
big things.
What does excise mean?
It just means it's a tax on stuff. So like a sales tax, but usually more targeted than that. So there'd be the alcohol tax. There'd be a tobacco tax. There was a...
Is that sometimes called a sin tax, or is a sin tax just some form of an excise tax?
It's like an excise tax that's more judgmental. So, you know, you can have an excise tax on something that you don't think is particularly bad. But when we tax alcohol or tobacco, you know, we can call it a sin tax because we're trying to make you feel bad about the fact that we're taking your money to pay for stuff when you buy it.
Yeah. Half of Fritos is tax. People don't realize it.
But they're worth it.
More than worth it. Yeah. All right. So then they did the excise taxes. Yeah. And then what after that? How did we get to this once a year thing?
So what the big turning point was, they needed two things. First, they needed a constitutional amendment that said the federal government could have a income tax because it had been attempted a couple times in the 1800s and thrown out. So in the 19-teens, that amendment passes and it now becomes possible. Then the other big thing that happens is prohibition, because one of their big taxes was taxing alcohol, and you can't tax something when you've completely, you know, banned it entirely. So they were getting ready to go into World War I, and they realized, oh my gosh, nobody is drinking this stuff legally anymore. We can't tax it. And so that was really the turning point where the federal income tax became a big deal, and it has been ever since.
You know, I had no idea. I thought it was always that way.
It's been just over 100 years.
Oh. So why is it so complicated? Why isn't there just a number? You know, why can't you just add up the shit you made and take a percentage and give it to the government. What's with all the what do they call, you know, the
itemizations and deductions and stuff?
Yeah. And the schedule. What the hell is schedule? What does that have to do with it? Why do they call it schedule?
That's a lot of questions.
Go ahead. Pick whatever you want to answer.
Pick two or three of those questions and answer them.
I don't actually know why they call them a schedule. Maybe because they take a little time to finish. I'm going to go back to the first question because I think I can answer that one.
What was the first question?
Guessing
was
quite
that,
as much.
Was it, was
why
the first
is it so
question?
Complicated?
Oh, okay.
I think that was the question.
Yeah.
So, you know, every time you have a tax, you're doing two things. You're bringing money into the government to pay for stuff, but then you're also creating some kind of incentive and you're making judgments about who is going to actually pay for that stuff. And so the rules keep getting tweaked and made more complicated, largely because we want to make sure that we don't create incentives to do weird stuff and we don't try to arrange the system of who is paying for what in a way that is that we think is unfair. So all
we
of these
already did
extra,
that though, didn't we?
When we threw the tea off the ship?
No, I don't know when it happened, but I don't feel like taxes are fairly distributed.
Well, I don't know if they are fairly distributed, but that's usually where these rule changes come from. They look at something that is going on and go, hold on, that's a loophole and that's unfair, or these people are paying too much for their ability to pay and they deserve a tax break.
Okay, got you. Yeah. And when you mentioned incentives earlier, are there incentives to pay taxes?
Oh, well, I mean, if you don't pay taxes, you can get in trouble and then they can come fine you and make you pay even more than you originally owed. But I meant more like incentives to not pay taxes. So,
oh, I see.
Yeah, doing stuff to get out of having to pay it. And then, you know, you create these weird things where everybody, you know, you used to be a person who had an Etsy store and now you're a corporation that has an Etsy store and you're still making the same, you know, doilies. I don't actually know what people put in their Etsy stores.
Right,
doilies.
Yeah.
They have a doily
doilies.
Business.
And, it's mostly doilies.
Yeah. And then you become a doily corporation to get the, you know, a different rate. But you're doing the same thing. So, you know, these sorts of incentives can lead people to doing stuff that is, you know, extra work and doesn't really contribute to anything. Or it can be incentives that we think are good. So like a sin tax. If you tax there's less sinning.
Like a child tax credit or a child care credit or things that we think are good in society, we give people tax breaks for them, right?
Right. You know, that's a way of saying that we think that, you know, taking care of children is good and, you know, trying to give people a little bit of a break because child care is expensive compared to people who don't have those costs.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you something, Nicholas. Try living a life without doilies. I think we should have the doily tax credit. I think, in fact, anything on Etsy should anybody selling on Etsy should just get a free ride. That's my feeling. Because
you love crafts.
Try living a life without crafts. It can't be done. It's a colorless world.
I live a craft-free existence.
Oh, jeez. All right. So it got complicated. And
that's right.
When did we first notice people coming up with the loopholes and the advantages? That, you know, the kinds of things that made Buffett say to his assistant that she paid higher taxes than he did. And I mean not the – I don't mean Margaritaville. I mean the other Buffett.
Jimmy Buffett doesn't pay a lot of taxes either.
I mean, told you this before, but I did when I first heard Buffett was like the richest person in the world at some point. I don't think he is anymore, but when I did think it was Jimmy Buffett.
Well, Jimmy Buffett, a lot of people don't realize that there's an entire Jimmy Buffett subculture.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I know that now. But anyway, sorry to I digress.
Are you a parrot head, Nicholas?
I can name probably three of his songs, I think. Is that enough?
Not to be a parrot head, no.
Okay.
No.
I mean, there's Margaritaville, and
yes.
I wrote this song in international waters, so I don't have to pay tax on it, and the one about the cheeseburgers.
Cheeseburger in Paradise, absolutely.
Yeah, those are the hits. Yeah. All right, wait. So when did the kinds of things that make it true for Buffett, non-beak Buffett, to say to his assistant, she pays higher taxes than he does? When did that start happening?
Well, there's always been this dance between the reforming the tax law and then people finding loopholes or lobbying to get loopholes added to it and then taking advantage of that. And then sooner or later, another reform wave comes around and they change a lot of stuff. And then that always has unintended consequences that some clever lawyer starts to find. So it's a little bit of a mix of the story where, you know, people are lobbying and using their position of influence to get favors and just stumbling on stuff that maybe wasn't intended to be that way.
Kind of a whack-a-mole thing?
It is a whack-a-mole thing. So, for example, right now there is a big movement to increase tax rates on people who are very high income. And people will point out that decades ago, the highest tax rate on income was as high as 90%. But the other thing that happened over that time is while the rates were going down, they closed a lot of the loopholes for exactly the types of things that you're talking about. I mean, Warren Buffett still has his, which I think is a special thing where you can, treat your – it has to do with the fact that as long as he doesn't sell any shares in his company, he doesn't have to pay tax. But, those 90% tax rates, hardly anybody ever actually wound up paying them because there were so many legal ways to reduce your taxable income – I think it was said that in the 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt introduced those high rates for the first time, the only person who actually paid them was John D. Rockefeller because he was just so rich that
he didn't notice.
he was.
So that's,
he was
where, that's where the concept effective tax rate comes in, right?
Yeah, exactly. So there is your tax rate that you actually pay, and then there's the rate that's on the schedule, but if you can wind up finding ways to, take advantage of all of these different advantages that are in the code that provide the, incentive for this and an incentive other than that, then you can have a substantial reduction in what you actually have to pay.
I gotta find those. And that's intentional. I gotta find those. all right, why don't we Adam, what did Will Rogers say?
Okay, I thought that's where you were going. Will Rogers said, the only difference between death and taxes is death doesn't get worse every time Congress meets. Stay tuned to find out more about taxes and if they can ever get better. The cat of the week is Smoochie from Highland Park, New Jersey.
Hey, listener, it's Zach Harper, Amin El-Hassan, and Anthony Mays of Cinephobe. You may be asking yourself, what is Cinephobe? Amin, would you like to fill in the people?
Cinephobe is the podcast where Zach and I watch movies that are poorly rated on Rotten Tomatoes and try to ascertain.
You're trying to ascertain?
Yes.
Okay.
Ascertain. Whether or not they're accurately poorly rated, or maybe they didn't get a fair shake. Cinephobe, produced by this guy, Anthony Mays.
Hey, that's me. I produced this show. I also watch the movies, even though that wasn't included in the description, and I also ascertain. This month is... Whoa! Oh, Maze, why'd you say that? Supercharge it. So that this promo can remain evergreen.
I feel like explaining a little bit more.
In 60 seconds?
I don't know. Maybe I don't bring attention to it. Assuring people like, look, if you listen, you're going to get it. Just give it time.
That's a good promo. Just listen to it.
Give it time.
You'll figure it out.
Is this the promo right now?
Isn't it? Okay, I think we got it.
Cinephobe.
Wherever you get podcasts.
Jesus fucks.
Get ready for the miracle of Mega, a comedy podcast from the staff of a fictional mega church.
And not only does he fuck, but he's the best at it.
I'm Holly Loren.
And I'm Greg Hess.
Our characters, Holly and Gray, welcome a new guest each week, played by some of the biggest names in comedy and podcasting.
Like Scott Aukerman, Lauren Lapkus, Paul Scheer, Jason Mantzoukas, Cecily Strong, and Duncan Trussell.
I just love to think about that, the light shining down on all those corpses in the water and Noah just going by and maybe a mom being like, please, we're running out of energy. Can you please let us on the boat?
It's completely improvised and it's devilishly funny.
Is there any question you have for us about, what it means to live a life in Christ?
I guess, how much do you think is bullshit?
There's a new episode every Sunday.
Listen and subscribe to Mega, wherever you get your podcasts.
Best I ever had. Best I y'all can do it. Y'all can do it. Y'all sing along. We, you know what I'm saying? Go, Jesus, you the best.
Jesus, you're the best.
You to be the best.
Jesus, you're Jesus, the best. You the be-
okay,
best
never mind.
Best I ever had. Best wow. I ever had.
And we're back with economist Dr. Nicholas Duquette. Paula?
All right, so Nicholas, I can't do my own taxes because I file in so many states every year, except for this year. And this year I'm making no money in any state, but I think I pay some sort of penalty for that as well. Would it be cheaper for me to just do it myself incorrectly?
Well, there are two ways that doing it yourself might wind up costing you money. The first is that you might overlook something that you are able to deduct or claim as a credit and pay tax that you don't have to and overpay unintentionally. The IRS will actually inspect your return. And if you, you know, make a mistake that they can see, they'll say, you know, we think you overpaid and here's the difference. But a famous study found that about 7% of returns that were audited actually overpaid taxes and they wound up owing less. So
70%.
7%. Oh, sorry.
Oh, 7%.
Oh,
yeah. Okay.
Oh, I like the. Then I'm just going to go outside the IRS building and chant, audit, audit, and see if I can get a little something back. Now, you know, I have to obviously sign the tax return. And I look at the numbers and I do it in front of my accountants, like so they can see that I'm looking at the numbers so they're not pulling anything. But I don't really think I'm fooling anybody. They know I don't know what I'm looking at. But they have used, because I, you know, the first time I ever had these particular accountants do my stuff, which was many, many years ago, like, I don't know, 35 years ago, maybe. I said to the guy right off the bat, I said, look, I want to pay taxes. I want to pay taxes. It's important. I feel good about doing that. I remember he said to me, he said, well, you know, we're not too aggressive, you know, and they've used that word a number of times with me, you know, oh, we're not going to be too aggressive, which suggests to me that there's a style of doing taxes as opposed to like a hard, fast rule. Am I right about that?
Absolutely. Well, so much of what you do is open to interpretation. Well, I shouldn't say so much of what you do, because for a lot of people doing, there is no room for aggression. A typical tax filer, you get a W-2 and you get a little thing that says how much you paid in like student loan interest. And then maybe you claim the child tax credit and that's it. It's like two pages and you've got to add four things. And it really is not that complicated to just do it yourself. But other things aren't like that. It's not just a dollar amount that somebody hands you and you go off and punch the calculator until it gives up. So say, for example, that I studied charitable donations. Say you donate a shirt to a thrift store. You are allowed to deduct the fair market value of that shirt, but who's to say what a shirt is really worth? It's more than zero and it's probably less than $1,000, at least, you know, my shirts are, but there's some range of numbers that you could say, yeah, that shirt was worth, if you said that shirt was worth $2, that probably wouldn't be very aggressive. If you said it was worth, you know, $50, the accountant might say getting a little aggressive with the, you know, what you said that shirt was worth. But
I think that depends, Nicholas, on whether or not it's a remarkably soft tri-poly blend shirt with self-portrait on the left breast. And a memorable quote on the back, which
I think the IRS is aware that tri-poly isn't a thing, Paula.
No, that's no. In fact, the IRS has come to me and said, "Could we get some of your shirts?" I feel good about that.
All right.
So how does the IRS work? I mean, I think of it as this sort of, you know, big whale of a building. With thousands of worker bees in there that are trying to catch people. That's how I think of the IRS. How many people work there? How do they find cheats?
And how many bees?
Well, the exact way that they decide who's going to get audited every year is actually a very closely guarded secret because...
Oh, no, it isn't. The guy who asked me for my shirts, I said, then tell me how you decide who gets audited. And he is a guy named Ed, by the way, who works at the IRS. And he said, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. And so I'm good. So that's how they do it. I didn't know you didn't know, or I would have told you right off the bat. I feel terrible keeping secrets. Yeah. Eeny, meeny, miny, mo.
I'm gonna kind of refocus this question, though, and say, do we know?
We really don't know. And they very purposefully don't tell us, because if they said, here's the rule we use to decide who gets audited, then, you know, people would look at that rule and say, I can go up to this amount without them coming after me. And so they want to keep it ambiguous so that you're not exactly sure what they're going to do. But, you know, there are certain things that we know increase the chances that they are going to audit you. If you have things on your tax return that are very hard to be precise about, or that are very easy to get aggressive about. For example, if you have income as a small business, that can be very open to more or less aggressive interpretations about exactly what you did. Those are the kind of people who are likely to get audited. You know, like if your tax return looks like what we all think Donald Trump's looks like, where you report hundreds of millions of dollars and then say you owe $0, we know that that's somebody who's going to get audited. But it's the people who are in between that who are, you know, more ambiguous.
Would you say that one of the things that might, you know, make them take a second look is a lot of cross-outs? Because that's, you know, because I when I look over what my accountants do, I say to them, could you white this out instead of crossing it out? Because I think this is going to attract unnecessary attention.
And you know what I did, Paula, which I regret, because it's definitely what I think led to my audit, is like when I listed all these deductions, after several of the dollar amounts, I wrote, yeah, that's it.
Oh, yeah, that and emojis. Don't use emojis. I just want to caution people right now. Okay, Trump kept saying he couldn't show his taxes because he was under audit, and it turns out there's no such rule. But in fact, because some people kept saying, well, how could you be under audit for that long? But apparently he has been under audit for like 10 years. Is the IRS understaffed?
Very understaffed. The number of returns they can audit has been going down every year for a long time. And that's because their budget keeps getting cut.
Because nobody likes them.
Right. They're the people who make you pay your taxes. So, for, you know, people who don't really think about what their role is in the system, it sounds like a tax cut to hear that the IRS is, you know, they're losing their jobs too. Yeah, let's get them. But they're the people who make sure that everybody else is more or less playing by the rules. And so if we don't have enough auditors, you're more likely to be able to, you know, sneak something by them without it getting caught. It's kind of like when Trump was saying that we wouldn't have so many COVID cases if we would just stop doing all of these tests. You know,
right.
Technically, you know, there wouldn't have been as many confirmed cases if we didn't test so much. But it you know, the looking for it isn't the same thing as the actual problem.
So if you're an average Joe or average Jane, who the kind of person you described, who pays off a W-2 and not much else, it's really in their best interest for the IRS to have lots of people auditing.
Absolutely. You know, that can increase your confidence that everybody else is paying what they're supposed to pay. And so people like Paula, who like paying taxes and having public services, can feel happy knowing that, you know, even people who aren't so positive about it are still playing by the same rules.
I don't want my taxes to be misused. It kills me that my taxes, you know, have been used to put children in cages, right? But I do want to do my share. In fact, I have a great idea now that we're talking about that. They don't have enough staffing at the IRS. You know how you can adopt a highway? What if on your tax return form, there was a question, do you want to adopt an IRS guy?
Auditor.
Or woman. Yeah. Do you want, like, I would do that. I would supply an auditor.
You would subsidize the IRS, basically.
I just think it's kind of a beautiful story when you do it that way. You know, it's like
you get a picture of the accountant you adopted every month, and it was a little progress report on how he's doing.
And they write you a letter.
Paula.
Every so often they write you a letter, and at holidays they write you a letter. I think that would be so great.
It would really humanize the IRS in a big way too.
Oh, you know, my auditor loves to be scritched just under his jawbone.
Now, I feel like we've gone somewhere else with this now.
Well, now it's like one of those things where you're adopting an animal, but yes. You're not actually. Because my auditor does. They love to be scritched just under the jawbone. And,
I think a lot of auditors do.
Yeah. And after that, they can see that graft. Whoo, boy, can they spot con work. So is there something that one should do when you get audited? Like, do you go with your tax preparer? Do you not? Are you allowed to not go and just send the tax preparer? Are there rules to getting audited?
Well, so you're supposed to keep all of your papers from the tax return, your past few tax returns, in a folder somewhere. And then
somewhere.
If you get audited, you got to pull them out and go through it together. I've never personally been audited, but the main problem with it is just that it's a time suck, where you get to all go through your papers together and they check every little thing that you did. Or I don't know, maybe in this case they go to your tax preparer and say, you know, how has this been the same every single year? And it's their problem. But you know, that's the real problem with auditing. It's not friendly and it takes a lot of time because they check everything, but it's not like being dragged away in handcuffs.
Why do you get a tax break if you donate to a nonprofit? Is there evidence that people would not donate to nonprofits if there wasn't a tax break?
They already do. Most people have actually not been eligible to take that deduction since it was invented, and especially after the 2017 tax law, only about 11% of tax returns filed the schedule where you can take that deduction. So most people, more than half of Americans donate to charity, and they're getting no tax benefit from doing it. So people will definitely make charitable donations even without that rule. But the reason why it does seem to be the case that when we do let people take that deduction and when they know they're going to be eligible for it, then they do tend to give more, especially the, high income philanthropists who, you know, can plan out to get the biggest bang for buck by making very large donations to their favorite causes, Bill Gates Foundation and so on.
Yeah, exactly. After Jeff Bezos and the like have, raped and pillaged the financially the land, then they can go, aren't I'm going to
give
generous.
A little back.
Yeah. Why not just make a tax that pays for nonprofits?
Well, we have that too. A lot of organizations have their biggest source of funding comes from government grants or government contracts. So they're already doing that as well. To me, the biggest thing that we get out of these the donation deduction is that people will donate to stuff that, for whatever reason, we don't want to spend tax money on. For church and state reasons, churches are obviously a big example. But then there's things like Bill Gates has spent a lot of money on vaccine research, even way back when the U.S. federal government wasn't interested in it. Before it was cool. When he was just the Windows guy, and then he was also doing vaccines, and everyone was like, "Yeah, Bill Gates, vaccines, computer virus, okay." But like animal shelters too, get most of their donations from people giving voluntarily, not from the Animal Control Bureau. Mm-hmm. There are things that people really care about that get done because of charitable giving that I don't think, maybe it is possible, but right now it's not the case that we spend public money on it. So, it's a nice mix and match. There's some of the stuff that gets paid for by tax dollars given to the nonprofit sector, and then there's, stuff that we do out of our own pockets.
Yeah. Well,
Dr. Duquette, thanks for auditing our knowledge of taxes. It seems like it was not very deep, ours knowledge, that is. But now we're going to take our new information and run it through the old Pouncedonator. Paula.
House band Christopher Still, taxes can be dry, so let's drench what the Pouncedonator spits out in a little background music. Thanks. And now we return to the Discovery Channel in-depth documentary on taxes. Of course, the colonists objected to the levying of a tax on their beloved tea. We don't want to pay for tea tax. We want to fill out long forms with schedules. That's right, with schedules. What's a schedule? You know, like, I can't pay that tax right now. It doesn't fit in my schedule. We'll be back after this message. Won't you give to adopt an IRS auditor? For less than the price of a cup of coffee a day, you can give less than a cup of coffee a day to an IRS auditor. A one-time contribution of $20 can provide a much-needed necktie or scarf for an IRS auditor. Do they even know it's tax season?
He is an economist at USC's Saul Price School of Public Policy. Dr. Duquette, thanks so much for returning to our podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Hey, thanks, Nicholas. You were great. Thank you so much.
Oh, that was fun.
Coming up, questions. We're sharing our favorite nuggets of wisdom, including the Pythagorean maxim. That's coming up right after this.
The spread of misinformation has fueled our cultural divide and increased our collective anxiety about the future. Tackling misinformation isn't a simple task, but it's important. And that's why I'm so excited to tell you about Conspirituality, a podcast that's dismantling New Age cults, wellness grifters, and conspiracy mad yogis.
On the show, a journalist, a cult researcher, and a philosophical skeptic walk into a bar, and the bartender says, no, it's not that old joke. They dive deep into current events such as RFK Jr.'s involvement in mainstreaming dangerous anti-vax rhetoric. They crowdsource, research, analyze, and dream up answers to the problem with, get this, proven science as their ultimate guiding light.
I highly recommend you check out Conspirituality's fascinating episodes on creating comedy in the MAGAverse with Jordan Klepper or RFK Jr. flirting with body fascism.
And you've listened to a bunch of them at this point, Paul, I know, and you tell me you love it.
I do. They're fascinating, and my favorite part is they use, wait for it, proven science.
And
if there's any kids listening, that's a class we used to take. Proven science as their ultimate guiding light. I love that.
From exploring cults to analyzing our cultural and political landscape, the Conspirituality podcast will help you stay informed about misinformation and help you resist fear tactics. Find Conspirituality on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
Fun fact, approximately 10 to 20% of U.S. power outages are caused by squirrels, who apparently still haven't learned not to use a hairdryer while the AC is running. Hey, Hey, Paula, you might have noticed, I think our listeners have too, that we are fond of quotations around here. We use them between segments of the show because, as Brendan Behan wrote, a quotation is like a rifle in the hands of an infantryman. It speaks with authority. So let's get some authority going here. We have asked our crew to bring in their favorite quotations.
I got one.
What do you got, Paula? Break it out. We need a good name for this segment, too, like Quote Party or something.
Yeah, Bonnie will write a theme song, no doubt. Yeah. Lose your leg, lose your leg, lose your leg.
Who said that?
Who said that?
I guarantee you, Tony is Googling leg quotes.
You know,
I'm
she
not
is.
Googling right now. I'm just sitting here quietly listening.
No, you know Oof. What? Right after Adam's fun fact, Tony was Googling squirrels. I know she was. I felt it. All right. So this is a very familiar quote, which is, of course, Ben Franklin said, a penny saved is a penny earned. But let me just say this about that. That will really fuck up your books.
Right. Because you're counting that 20 twice, and then the auditors are going to find that and be like, sir, you earned a penny and saved a penny, but there's still only one penny.
Exactly. You got nothing in a sea of W-2s that way.
I think that's a really good point. I mean, look, we should probably look back at Ben Franklin's books and see if he was declaring two pennies for every penny he got.
Yeah. Guy died penniless, by the way.
Well, he never saved him. He just said he should. Well, that's
no,
he a said, lovely,
he said, do
lovely
as I say,
quote.
Not as I do. That was his, too.
That was also his quote, too? Well, yeah. I have a quote that's also kind of a familiar one, but it is my favorite quote about literacy. Are you ready for it? Here it comes. Outside of a dog, a book is man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it's too dark to read. That's Groucho Marx.
Oh.
Wow.
Yeah, and he's right about that.
He is absolutely right about it. He was a passionate advocate for literacy as well as dogs.
Yeah.
All right.
Mrs. Who's the woman I always liked? Oh, come on, help me out. Margaret,
Margaret Dumont.
Dumont.
Yeah,
Margaret
just
Dumont.
The best.
Oh, my gosh, I love her. Oh, Mr. Quackenbush. all right.
Oh, wow. Maybe she can call sometime.
She's dead.
Bonnie just stepped out of the show and put on her producer hat. Bonnie, can you come on back in here?
So let's get the quotes a popping.
Bonnie, okay. Edify us.
Well, I have two. One of them is from Dorothy
Parker. Of
course you do. Of course I do. One of them's from Dorothy Parker, and it is, the cure for boredom is curiosity. There is no cure for curiosity.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, there's a cure for curiosity. Tony, why don't you tell us what it is?
Man, when you Google what is the cure for curiosity, it just brings up the Dorothy Parker quote.
Oh, it does?
How See, do you know that?
I didn't really think you were Googling that.
Well, since See, you had already made was. Fun of me for doing it, I might as well just do it. It's like if I
why don't you, you why don't you
accuse
Google
me of killing someone?
Why don't you Google
Tony, that's like saying, well, since you just accused me of having a heroin problem, I see no reason not to shoot up right now in my eyeball.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are the impeachment hearings over? Because Trump is really missing not having Tony on his team.
Oh my gosh.
It's a fabulous, fabulous legal argument you just, fabulous legal argument you just made. They were going to do it anyways. Tony Anita Hall.
Tony, as long as we've got you under the microscope, what's your quote?
No, wait. I have my other one. I have a second one.
Oh, I forgot.
I thought we were okay. All over that as a nation, but okay, Bonnie.
No. Here
right,
we go.
Get ready to Google, Tony. Get ready.
Okay, get set. Here we go. Optimism. One of the most important qualities of a good leader is optimism, a pragmatic enthusiasm for what can be achieved. Even in the face of difficult choices and less than ideal outcomes, an optimistic leader does not yield to pessimism. Simply put, people are not motivated or energized by pessimists. And that is from a guy named Bob Iger, who Paula and I actually know, who wrote a book called The Right of a Lifetime, Lessons Learned from 15 Years as CEO of the Walt Disney Company.
I think he's wrong.
But I think he has a really good point about the optimism.
I think he could have said it a little shorter, but yes, he has a very good point.
Yeah, it's a long quote. It is a long quote, but the optimism, if you have a negative leader, that's really an uphill battle.
So this is Eisner?
Yeah, Bob Iger.
Oh, Bob Iger.
Not Eisner.
Now, what I would suggest, Bob, if you're listening, or Bob's family, I would go back in there and just go with the sentence, leaders should be optimistic because no one wants to follow a negative leader. Because your entire quote says nothing more than that. I hate to sound pessimistic, but I don't like the prospects for Iger's book's future.
All right, wait. How about this, Bob Iger and family? How about this? Few footprints follow the trail of a whiner.
Ooh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's both sagacious like mine, but also colorful, and there's a metaphor involved. And Paula, you are a better writer than Bob Iger.
Well, I don't know about that.
Nope, you are.
No, you are. Bob Iger may have had a writer go with him on this journey.
Well, that guy deserves to be fired, because this is just
so
overly
two
wordy.
Writers to come up with that? Really?
No. Isn't there an analogy here for you guys? Like, say, when you're doing improv or acting, if you have somebody working with you who goes like, well, that isn't good, and, you know, blah, 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 and they squelch an idea right away, isn't that kind of like a killer in terms of moving forward?
Yes, I agree with the quote, Bonnie. If you're saying negative people don't make as good leaders as optimists, I think in general that's true. I think the captain of the Titanic maybe should have been more realistic. Personally, I think there's a time when being optimistic about the you know, how your boat's going to be doing over the next couple of hours, it might not be the best thing, but...
Well, okay, but yeah, you know what, though? A lot of what the captain of the Titanic said didn't get written down. He had a tremendous amount of optimism where other people wouldn't have. For example,
yeah, that's true.
This is a quote from him. He said, I think we can live down here.
Here, I found another one. I just Googled him. I found another one. He said, people, you might notice it's getting a little humid in here.
No,
just,
he said,
just really
is it
optimistic.
Me? Is it me, or is it getting humid? Stop Googling.
I'm not Googling. That's
yeah,
not a real
boy.
I was joking. He didn't really Googling. Say that. What are you doing?
He did.
Oh, here's
no, he
a,
did.
Here's another great quote from the captain of the Titanic. Free salt water, everybody.
That was good.
Yeah. Yeah.
See, Google is a great tool.
If only we had some dough, we could make pretzels. That was
and we could put it on a stick and fry it.
All right, wait, Tony,
yeah.
Did you do a quote? Did you give us a quote yet?
No,
not yet. Bonnie had two.
Oh yeah.
Oh. Crucifying me for that. Oh, I was being pessimistic.
Well, that wasn't really a crucifixion.
What, what happened to Bob Iger's champion of positivity? Go ahead, Tony.
I was going to say, good for you, Tony.
I think Bob Iger put it best when he said,
I don't even know what's happening.
I think Bob Iger put it best when he said, this is the part of the show where we're going to ask Toni Anita Hull to recite her quote. We've prepared this in advance, and this is the part where we do that. And so with very little further ado, I would like to ask Toni Anita Hull to offer up that aforementioned quote.
Good work, Adam.
Bob paid by the word Iger. all right, Toni, go ahead.
So I chose a quote from Anita Loos, who wrote Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. She's one of my favorite writers in the world. One, she's she also is a screenwriter in the silent film era and very successful. I've been published writing about her. So, you know, take that.
Wow.
It is, for so the human heart behaves through all its ups, downs, tears, laughter, and harrowing surprises. Well, my friend, that is life and art as they've got to be, either in or out of the show shops. Show shops. That's a
show shop?
To say. Show shops.
Show shock?
Show shops.
What a great
either
quote.
Either in or out of the show shops. Show
shops. That was a great quote. Good for you, Toni.
I feel like you're patronizing me, Bonnie, and I don't appreciate it.
Well, look, Bonnie's not one to talk because she's the one who quoted Bob Iger reading the phone book. So
it's one of my
favorite. She doesn't have a leg to stand on.
But
can you say it again? I don't think I followed it. I don't think I followed it.
Yeah, what's a show shop? Wait a minute.
I don't think I did.
What's a show shop?
It was great.
I'm not talking to any of you right now, so you can just move on.
No, I'm asking you to say it again.
Wait a minute. I just have Amy Klobuchar. Amy Klobuchar, how was Toni's quote?
It was really good. She's a really good American. I'm so proud of her.
Do you know that just recently Joe Biden said to Amy Klobuchar, I feel like you're patronizing me and I don't like it.
All right, if Toni's not going to offer it up again.
What's a show shop? What's a show shop?
No, never mind. You know, it just cut everything.
Toni, I think
she's
didn't hear you.
She's
we're literally saying we just didn't hear you.
I don't know what a show.
I'm crying.
Well, stop crying and tell us what a show shock is.
No,
it's a show shop. A show shop.
Show shop. Shop. With a B. Shop. Show.
She sells show shops by the seashore.
Show shop. Oh my God.
No wonder she wrote silent films.
Oh my God, no, she wrote. Okay, you know what? Everyone can shove it.
Oh, you were saying shove it, not show shop.
Show shops.
What
no,
is
she
a
wrote
show
the women?
Shop? Is it a sexual term?
No. Oh, I can't deal with it. I can't right now. It's too much. I'm sorry.
That was really good, Toni. That was really good.
I don't.
Okay. Does a show shop suck some sort of unwanted substance out of a baby?
You know, you know when you Google show shop, it takes you to a website for riding apparel.
That makes sense.
Yeah, remember when you bought that expensive shirt for your daughter?
Yeah, the show shirt. Yeah, those are expensive.
You can tell that Anita Loos was a writer and not a speaker because, you know, show shop is fine on the page, but boy, try to say it at the end of a quote.
Is it really show shop? Jesus.
We've angered Tony, and now she won't tell us what show shop means. That's our punishment. That's it.
It serves us right.
Her lips are sealed. We'll never get it out of her what show shop is. And you know what? We deserve that. I just want to say, I can't speak for all of us, but I deserve.
I hate the quote segment.
I like it. I think it worked out really, really well.
Okay, now, and thus lacking a theme song for it, we come to the end of our quote bonanza tonight. Paula, what's going on in your Poundstone product empire this week?
Wow.
Well, Adam, I don't know if you heard about the name change on my product empire. It's now Show Shop.
That actually fits.
Oh, yeah.
Adam, the mission of Poundstone Industries is to meet the needs of the American people and some Icelandians. The way we are doing that currently is by offering my book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness, in paperback or the audio version, which is on CD. Kirkus Reviews said of it, "The concept of a comedian doing a series of stunts to find happiness seems like a pure romp, and there are plenty of great laughs, but that's not the whole story. A deeply revealing memoir in which the pathos doesn't kill the humor, delivers more than it promises. I recommend that people get it from their local bookstore, but if your local bookstore doesn't have it, you can find The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness at the online store at my website at paulapoundstone.com, or you can get it at the show shop. And if that doesn't give you everything you need to go on, I also make video messages for your friends, loved ones, neighbors, and former bosses at cameo.com/paulap33. Here's a sample. "Hi, Darren, it's me, Paula Poundstone, reaching out to you on behalf of Cindy. You remember Cindy, who gave you 10 years of her working life without you ever giving her a promotion? Well, Cindy would like you to know that she hopes that you're all well and that the widgets are flying off the shelves and that she now runs Paramount Studios." That's cameo.com/paulap33.
Well, that sounds great. I know I'll be going to cameo.com/paulap33 to send some messages to try to repair some relationships in my life where people were saying things about each other's quotes that I'm sure they didn't mean. All right, subscribe to this podcast. It's free. You get it every week at no charge. And hey, if there's something you want to hear about, something you're curious about that you want to hear us talk about on the show, drop us a line at nobodylistenstopaulapoundstone@gmail.com. Once again, that's nobodylistenstopaulapoundstone@gmail.com, and that is our show. Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone is hosted by Paula Poundstone and yours truly, Adam Lefelber. Special thanks to our guest, Dr. Nicholas Duquette.
Yay!
And how about that house band trumpeter, Christopher Still?
Oh my gosh, he
was great. Our show is produced by Paula Poundstone, Adam Felber, Bonnie Burns, Ken Lezebnik, and Tony Nita Hull. Mixing by Michael Hoagie. Starburns production by Land Romo. Transcription services for the show provided by TranscribeMe, a premier internationally used transcription service. Use code Paula Poundstone when placing your order at transcribeme.com to receive an expedited service.
That's our show for tonight. Won't somebody please listen to me?
Didn't you mean to say that's our show shop for tonight? Won't somebody please listen to me? Yeah.
What is show shop? And why is Tony guarding it so carefully?
I think she felt like there was some pressure coming on her from Bonnie Burns, and so we were never going to get that quote again. and I'll be damned if I'll Google it.
Show shop. Show shop. Remember that song, One Tin Soldier?
Yes.
And then they turned over. They turned over like a thing, and show shop was all it said. Do you remember that?
Yeah. All it said on the bottom was show shop.
One tin soldier, da 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 da. You know,
I had a friend who, his one entire act that he did was seeing how many marshmallows he could get into his mouth while playing One Tin Soldier.
Oh my gosh. I would watch that.
Maybe it's show stock.
I think it was show shop.
Shop.
What was the rest of it about?
Doesn't make any sense.
Boy, we poked that beehive. I think she's asleep. And just from her sleep, she's going to show shop.
She sat bolt upright in bed and yelled, show shop!
Gosh,
he's laughing.
Anita Luz is looking down from heaven right now. saying to Tony, tell them what show shop is.
I Googled Anita Luz quote show shop and nothing came up. There was something about us. What? It's not show shop?
No, you're not going to find it on the internet.
Oh, she's not going to let you find it.
Oh, there was something about when your play's not successful, something about a play not successful, what to hawk.
I will not have you reading me Anita Luz quotes from the internet.
Yeah, right.
Podcast Network.